We are ready to start our chapter on stocks. Exciting stocks, sexy stocks, risky stocks. Yeah. Stocks in the world of investing get most of the press. They're the ones that are most talked about. Which ones, stocks or bonds, are more important? Well, it actually turns out that bonds are more important. You need both. But stocks are where the action is, even though bonds are more important for the economy, because if an entity such as a corporation or a state and local government or the federal government can't borrow money to do what it needs to be done, we have serious problems. But stocks are ownership, and that means that we are participating in the vibrant part of the economy, the ever changing business part. And that means that we can lose a lot of money. Because here is a popular email that circulated about the internet in roughly 2002. If you had invested $1,000 in Nortel Networks stock last year, you would have $50. If you had purchased $1,000 of Budweiser beer, drank the beer, and returned the cans, you would have $78. So our stock tip for today is to start drinking heavily. You younger folks have never heard of Nortel Networks. It used to be called Northern Telecom, and it built telephone equipment and quickly became a darling, along with many, many other internet and telecommunication stocks in the late 90s, only to crash and burn. But, you know, nothing's new, folks. This is nothing new. In the late 90s, it was internet stocks and telecommunications. But then, in the 2000s, it was financial innovation. So, in 2009, it was the same exact email, but instead of Nortel Networks, it was replaced by AIG and Citigroup and WaMu and Wachovia. Yeah, it's a cycle. It's a cycle, folks. Slide number two. Why invest in stocks? Well, stocks represent ownership in a corporation. So when you buy stocks, when you invest in stocks, you are part owner of those corporations, which is why stocks are often called equities, equity financing. Whereas bonds are debt financing. You're not buying into the entity. You are lending that corporation, that municipality, the government, you're lending them money. But when you buy stocks, you're actually buying into that company. You're part owner. And so why, if you're a corporation, would you issue stock? Well, there are various reasons. To raise money to start or expand a business, you got a great idea and you need some more financing. And you're sure the public's going to like it, so you sell stock to expand or start the business, normally to expand the business. Or if you're already a public company, there's already stock out there, you can issue more stock to pay for ongoing business expenses. And that is something that is done over and over and over again here in San Diego by biotech firms. Biotech firms need hundreds of millions of dollars billions. No, hundreds of millions. I'm sorry. It costs about $1 billion, right, to get a drug to market. And, you know, they got this great idea, but there's no money coming in the door, so they got to somehow get it, and no bank is going to lend it to them. Nobody's going to allow them to sell bonds. You know, there's no income coming in, so they sell stock. And once a company becomes large enough and is profitable enough, then it is simply expected that they are going to go public. For example, Google. When Google was making money hand over fist in the early 2000s, the co-founders were not really sure that they wanted to take the public company. Yeah, right. Then came along the folks from Wall Street and said, you know what, if you take this public, you're going to become instant multi-billionaires in one day. And that changed their mind. So the people who start the business, who get it up and running and take it public, often become multi-millionaires, multi-billionaires. The gentleman from Facebook, right. He had a $1 billion tax bill when they took Facebook public. The tax bill was $1 billion. Okay. Right. And as we said, you know, once you become public, you don't have to repay that money. You've sold the shares. It's up to investors to sell it to other investors. But you are now a public corporation, which means you have certain rights and you have certain responsibilities that a private company does not have to conform to. A private company doesn't have to tell you how much money they have in the bank. They don't have to tell you how much money they made. They have to tell the IRS, but that's it. Whereas if you're a public entity, every 3 months you have to, means you sold stock to the world, you have to disclose how much cash you have, what your earnings are, what your expenses are, what the sales are. You have to disclose all this information. Why? Because you're public. And for people to make informed decisions, they have to understand what's going on. Does that make sense? I think it does. Now, why would we purchase stock? Well, as we said, you are now part owner. So you're going to share in the success of the corporation. And one of the things that we don't normally think about when we discuss stock investing is that you are a limited liability owner. What does that mean? Well, you'll learn more about this if you take Business 120, Introduction to Business. There are various types of businesses. The most common is what's called a sole proprietorship. And you and the business are one and the same. So if the business incurs debts above and beyond the worth of the business, and the business goes bankrupt, they can come after you and say, hey, you know, you still owe us this money. Whereas if you're a stock investor, you are limited to just how much you have bought the stock for. So you paid $100 for one share of stock. The company goes bankrupt, that's it. You can just lose your $100. They can't come after you for anything else if the corporation still owes money. Now, there are some instances where people set up what are often called sham corporations, you know, just phony corporations, to try to hide behind what is called the corporate veil. And there are methods for piercing the corporate veil, and we won't get into those. But just know that the idea, when it's a real company, bona fide, you know, they're trying their best to make it, you're only on the hook for how much money you paid. Now, here are the two things that people think about when they think about stock investing. Dividends and capital gains. The corporation is eligible to distribute earnings to the shareholders. And those are called dividends. And dividends don't lie. That's money in your pocket. Now, you can think of them like interest payments, but they are not interest payments. Interest payments are mandatory. If the corporation sells bonds, they must pay that interest. They must pay that principal back, or else they're going to get hauled off the court. Whereas when a corporation sells shares to the public, they are under no obligation whatsoever to pay dividends. Now, some companies have been paying dividends for over 100 years, General Electric. But others don't pay any dividends, so you have to remember that. The one benefit that people always think about is the capital gains. They think about capital gains because that's what they want. Well, yeah, I bought it for $10, I sell it for $20 or whatever. The stock price could go down. Remember, there's a possibility it can go down. So with these dividends and with these capital gains, is anything guaranteed? No, not at all. Now the book lists the possible increased value from stock splits. dear students, there is no increased value from stock splits. It is an accounting measure. And I want you to take a look at this, because one of the problems is very similar to what the example we have here on slide number 3. If you had one share at $100, what's the value of your shares? 1 times 100, $100. If the company has a stock split, you now have two shares. Yippee! You know, what happens to the price of the stock? It goes down by half. The value is still $100 because now you have two shares worth $50. It's a psychological increase. In fact, some companies will split their stock as a way of telling the world that, hey, they think things are doing well. But they're not going to say that, because if they don't happen to do well, then they could get sued. So they'll split their stock as a way of saying, hey, this is pretty cool. About 10 years ago, Qualcomm, which is a company I was following at the time, we owned some shares, and they split their shares, and we were like, what are you splitting the shares for? And of course, they won't say anything, but I felt that, you know what, they're probably trying to tell the world that things are going well, because things were going well outside the United States, and it turns out that they did. It turns out that they had a nice run from there. You might have heard of Mr. Warren Buffett, and I'm gonna come back to him. He's one of the best investors of our time, if not the best investor of our time, and he's a really I think I spelled his name wrong. I think it's two T's. He's extremely self-effacing, very humble, down home. He lives in Omaha, Nebraska. He's the world's richest man on and off over the last several years. And he lives in Nebraska in the same house he bought 40, 50 years ago. A three-bedroom. He's a very humble man. But he has always thought that stock splits are ridiculous. He doesn't like them. He thinks that it's stupid. Well, he's got a point. He's being a little bit ornery. He's being a little bit of a curmudgeon. He has refused to split his stock. A single share now goes for over $200,000. Uh-huh. But if Coca-Cola or General Electric or McDonald's or Johnson & Johnson had refused to split their stock from their inceptions, their stocks would be, shares would be over 100, 200, or more, probably in the case of GE. So you understand, when we do, there's going to be a problem, and make sure you check this slide out for when you do that problem. Cool. Slide number 4. What can we reasonably expect from stocks? Well, the answer is, history tells us we should be pretty darn happy. We should be pretty excited about investing in stocks. Because stocks have returned 8, 9, 10%. Some have done better, some have done worse. But traditionally, half of that return was from dividends. Stockholders used to expect 4, 5, 6% in dividends. That was often as much or more than bonds were returning in interest payments. Why? Because stocks were considered much riskier than bonds. But in the great run-up of 1980s and 90s, dividends fell to less than 2% and down to 1% at the peak in 2000. Because people wanted capital gains. Don't pay me dividends. I'm not interested in them. I want you to reinvest the money back in the company and make the company grow because I want capital gains. And there's some reasons for that, taxes and the like. But for these people, in my humble opinion, many of them really were not owners of a stock, of a company. They were renters. They were short-term owners. They didn't really want to own the company for the long term. And that, you know, makes it more volatile. And we saw what happened. In 2000 to 2002, the market dropped almost 50%. Recently, dividends have been around 2% or so, which, you know, doesn't sound like much, but when you look at what credit unions and banks are paying on their savings accounts, it actually looks pretty good. And some companies are paying more. So don't forget dividends. Slide number 5. This is a quote from a book called One Up on Wall Street, a fabulous book that you need to read if you are interested in investing in stocks. It's written by a gentleman by the name of Peter Lynch. He was one of the best investors of the 20th century, 1977 to 1989. He ran the Fidelity Magellan Mutual Fund and racked up 29% a year. Yeah, yeah, not too many people are going to, they're not going to pull that one off. And he wrote the book in 88, and people thought it was going to be a self-congratulatory, puffing himself up. And it was anything but, folks. It's a very good book. You want to read it. He has humility, which I think is a very important trait in the investment world, because stocks will make you humble. Here he answers the question: if stocks are the best long-term financial investment, how come they're considered so risky? For two decades after the crash of 29, stocks were regarded as gambling by a majority of the population. This impression wasn't fully revised until the late 1960s, when stocks once again were embraced as investments, but in an overvalued market that made most stocks very risky. Historically, stocks are embraced as investments and dismissed as gambles in routine and circular fashion, and usually at the wrong times. Stocks are most likely to be accepted as prudent investments at the moment they are not, and vice versa when the world is going through a crisis of sorts and the organic matter has hit the ventilating device. People don't want to touch stocks, but that's the best time, right? It's the emotions, right? As Warren Buffett says, investing is simple, but it ain't easy. You can't run with the crowd. And he called it his cocktail party theory, which, it's adorable. He would go to a cocktail party, and he'd be talking to people. I'm a doctor, you're a lawyer. Oh, that's great, you're a lawyer. What are you? I'm a mutual fund manager. And they all would move away from him. that's nice, and they run away, because they just lost a ton of money in the downturn. And he'd think, okay, now it's a good time to invest. And then the market would do better, and you go to a cocktail party, and they'd say, oh, what are you? Oh, I'm an architect. What are you? Oh, I'm a mutual fund manager. Oh, really? Do you have any good tips on stocks to buy? I see the market's done really well lately. And you think, all right, you know, things are fairly valued. And so then he'd go to a cocktail party. What are you? Oh, yeah, I'm an engineer. That's great. And you're and what are you? I'm a mutual fund manager. Really? Well, let me tell you. My buddy just told me about this stock. I don't know the name, but I do have the ticker symbol. He told me it was going to double in 6 months. That's when he knew the market was about to crash. When the people are giving the stock tips to the mutual fund manager, whose job it is every day to investigate companies and decide which ones are good investments, you know it's time for a crash. And sure enough, there'd be a crash, a downturn, a market correction, whatever you want to call it. And nobody would want to talk to him at the cocktail party, and he'd say, okay, time to buy again. Pretty wild, isn't it? Yeah, I think so.
So how do we deal with those times of volatility, those times when the markets crash? Do we try to get out before it happens? No. The key is to take a long-term perspective. So let's take a look at slide number 6, where what we see are rolling 10-year periods. This is the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which you hear about every day in the news, and we'll discuss in our next presentation. And what we're looking at are the returns for 10-year periods. You put your money in 1 year, 10 years later, did you lose or did you gain? And if we start back in the Great Depression, we see that there were some periods where you lost money over 10-year periods. And this is just showing you what happened from point A in 1 year and then point B 10 years later. Doesn't show you what happened in between. Oh boy, was it ugly. But here we come out of the Great Recession, out of World War II, and stocks move in two directions, up and way up in the go-go 50s and 60s. Science! New technologies! The atomic age. Energy would be too cheap to measure. Yeah, well, flying cars. Yeah, well, it didn't work out so well. Some things did, some things didn't. And this is what Mr. Peter Lynch was talking about. At the end of this era, in the end of 1960s, stocks were very expensive. In fact, some were outrageously expensive. And that's the time when you hear people say, ooh, is it too late to get in? When you hear people say that, right, it's too late to get in. And so stocks didn't do very well in the 1970s. And there were various reasons for this. First of all, they were very expensive, right? Secondly, the baby boom generation was coming of age. You know, there were all kinds of upheavals going on in the 1960s, civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, the first oil crisis of 1973, Watergate, Vietnam, the culture wars. But most importantly, with regard to the economy, was the baby boom generation. Coming of age, all needing to go out and get jobs and buy refrigerators and houses and cars. And so it was a very difficult time for the economy. And we look at the 10-year rolling period here, and we see that stocks barely made a gain. Barely, you know, just almost hit zero. But they started coming back. In the 1980s, the baby boom generation is now, in the great economy, has been absorbed into the economy, and we see the stocks move. And here, what do you hear people say here? Ooh, is it too late to get out? Right, it's too late to get out. The 73-74 bear markets were savages, and that was the time to buy, right? And we see coming out of the 70s, the 1980s, the 1990s, new technologies, globalization, computers, internet, and in the 1990s, stocks went up and up and up in three directions, up and up, up, up and away. And what did you hear people say? Ooh, is it too late to get in, right? Indeed, stocks were wildly overvalued. And then we had the internet bubble crash, and then the housing bubble crash, and here's the Great Recession. Ooh, is it too late to get out? Yes, it's too late to get out. Now's the time to buy, but nobody wants to buy when the market's falling 50-60%, and you see, you have to go back to the Great Depression to see rolling 10-year periods where stocks lost money. But this was a phenomenal opportunity to buy. Because see what's going on? Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Now, the last rolling 10-year period looks like, oh, my goodness, we're off to the races again. Well, I don't know. I don't know if this is going to repeat itself. But the reason this last rolling 10-year period has jumped much higher than the previous six or seven rolling year periods is because 2018 fell off the 10-year period, right? Exactly. 2008, after January 1st, 2019, the year that was 2008, where the market crashed 50-60%, is no longer in the rolling 10-year period. So that's why it's spiked up a bit here. But is it going to repeat the same pattern? I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's going to more moderate this time. But that doesn't mean I'm right. It could get a whole lot worse. It could get a whole lot better. And you'll hear people say, if in 5-10 years you start hearing people say, oh, is it too late to get in? You'll know that we're about ready to do the exact same thing we've done twice before. Right. Capitalism, folks, ain't perfect. It might actually be the worst economic system ever devised by humans, except for all the others. It's a history of booms and then subsequent busts. But if we take a long-term perspective, and the world doesn't end, and we patiently, prudently invest our 50, 100 bucks a month into long-term oriented investments, and we'll discuss those as we go along, and most of us are going to use mutual funds, and the world doesn't end, then we should do pretty well. What do you think? I think so. So far, it's worked for me, and I'm really old.
Slide number 7. What are the risks? Well, there are many, folks. The stock could plummet because the company could fail. That's called business failure risk. The market as a whole will, not that they use the word could, but it would. It does. Markets fall. They go up, they go down. We see this. History tells us that. And then the global investment risk, which is also called foreign risk. And, you know, traditionally, 50 years ago, the companies in other countries just did not have the same standards of accounting as the United States of Armenia. I'm sorry, the United States of America. But all that has changed. Many have better accounting now. Yeah, some of them shook their heads when Enron came along and Countrywide. So the young folks don't have a problem with this. They believe the world is global. You know, some of the politicians taking advantage of hate speech notwithstanding. There is room for optimism. The problem with global investment risk is not so much the accounting standards, it's the currency risk. And this is subtle, and I'm not going to ask you this question or anything, but what, remember the interest rates going down, bond prices going up? Interest rates going up, bond prices down. Well, same idea, seesaw. If the dollar gets stronger, you think that's cool. Well, yes, it is for tourists going abroad and for us buying products from outside the United States. But it's harder for our companies to do business outside the United States, and your investments outside the United States are already go down. All other things being equal, and they never are. So that's the risk we face with currencies. If the dollar gets weaker, our investments outside the United States become worth more. So it's actually an interesting relationship. Over time, it tends to wash. Over time, because the markets move in cycles. Right now, the dollar is very strong. So it's a great time to go buy investments outside the United States. But it's a difficult time for our multinational corporations who are trying to make money outside the United States. And then the liquidity risk. This is not usually a problem with stocks, except for very small companies called penny stocks. But these are companies you should never even consider. You shouldn't even talk about them in polite company. They are scams in general, and you'll see some examples on the website. Slide number 8. How do we reduce the risk of stocks? Well, the problem with risk is that it's difficult to measure. It's easy to measure return. How much did you start with? How much did you end with? What dividends did you get at the same time along the way? That's your total return. That's pretty easy to measure. How long did it take you to get there? But risk is difficult to measure, and we have some measures, and they're not very good. And it's even more difficult to anticipate. One of the best ways is to emphasize large companies that pay consistently rising dividends. Why? Because these are the companies that are big enough to withstand the storms in the economy what will always occur, folks. They're not going to get away from those. And so the way to these companies have the resources. Now, are they going to explode on the upside like small companies can that find new technologies? No, they're not. These are the tried and true companies. And they just, Peter Lynch calls them stalwarts, you know, the stalwarts, the blue chip, as we'll see. We're getting all ahead of ourselves. Diversification. Having more than, more just one company. And this is why we have mutual funds, and we'll discuss this in detail in chapter 13. But the National Association of Investors Corp, sometimes called betterinvesting.org, they have this 5-stock rule of thumb. You buy 5 stocks. 1 will do poorly and make you sad. 3 will do about average, and they'll go up and down with the market. And then 1 will explode. And you'll say, wow. And sure enough, folks, I have found this to be pretty darn close. The one you did not think was going to explode, that explodes. The one you expected to be the next big thing, that falls into the porcelain oasis. And then the other 3 just sort of bounce around. And then time is the last and best strategy, because if we are consistent, if we are prudent, if we have a long-term time horizon, and don't panic, when the market falls, because it's going to, you have to be ready for those times when the market falls. You have to be ready emotionally. You've done pretty darn well. Now, there's no guarantee of the future, but so far, so good. Slide number 9, scams. It certainly hasn't helped the cause of stock investing that there are many, many scams out there ready to take your money. One of the oldest and still most prevalent scams is called pump and dump. The scam artists pump up the price of a stock, usually a penny stock that nobody knows about, and it's not really a company. It's somebody's garage in Idaho or Iowa or one of those places that starts with the letter I. And the buzz drives up the stock price. Oh, hey, I bought these shares for 2 cents and now they're up to 5 cents. Wow, I'm going to buy more and then I'll up to 10 cents. Well, what's happening? The scam artists, they're the ones who are manipulating the price of the stock. They're raising it to make you think you're making a ton of money. And then it hits 25 cents and the scammers disappear. They dump all the shares and they run. And then the suckers realize, uh-oh, we're screwed. Too late. So you might have seen some of the movies, the boilerplate, the boiler room. And then Wolf of Wall Street, that's what they were doing. They were pumping and dumping shares. It's nothing new. It's been done for hundreds of years. It was a big thing back in the 1920s. Yeah, it wasn't even illegal in the 1920s, believe it or not. Before the 1930s, after the Great Crash, they finally made it illegal. But it's hard to find these people because they don't stay put, folks. They don't have a sign up in the outdoors. They move from, they like the southern states. You know, there's a movie about having them in New York. No. They're in Arizona, and then they go to San Diego, and they go to Florida, and they like to be warm. I can't blame them for that. Slide number 10. And occasionally, investors get caught up in what are called manias, bubbles. And for stocks, the last mania was the internet. Although a few stocks have had mania tendencies. Apple was one of them a few years ago. But the last stock mania was the internet. Since then, we really haven't had a stock mania. People say, what about 2008 and 2007, you know, the Great Recession? No, that wasn't a bubble in the stock market, folks. That was a bubble in the real estate market. And then the bonds were tied to the real estate mortgages. Yeah, that was. Don't blame the stock market for 2008 and 2009. But in 1999, yeah, the stock market was way overpriced because of internet stock. And before that, in the early 70s, you had the Nifty 50. I like that. It's a great name, isn't it? A few dozen stocks that, no matter what, didn't matter what price you paid for them, they're always going to go up. One of them was Polaroid. You've heard of Polaroid. The name lives on, although the company's long gone. I would never invest in a company whose name rhymes with hemorrhoid. I just don't think it's a good idea. And then in the 1920s, there were stocks that were just, no way you're going to lose. One of them was Radio Corporation of America. You've heard of Radio Corporation of RCA? Yeah, at the height of the bubble, it sold for $290-some. I forget exactly what, $290? 3 years later, $2. And it never recovered to its glory. The name still lives on, although the company, I don't know where they are. In 1840s, there were 400 railroad firms. 400! How many are now? Not less than 5. How about the granddaddy of them all? You're not going to believe me, folks, but here's a great book. It's just so much fun. I know a lot of you millennials don't like books, but books are cool, folks. They're much better than movies. The pictures are better. I'm not talking about graphic novels. This book is called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. It was written in the 1840s, and it still shocks people. It's amazing how insane humans are. And one of my students said it best. He said, look, it's easier to fool a million people than it is to fool one. Good point. Look at some of our politicians. Anyway, in the early 1600s, tulip bulbs were all the craze in Holland. They actually came from Turkey, but they moved to the Netherlands, and these things started to be sold like stocks. They started to be sold like bonds. Tulip bulbs! You know what I'm talking about. These things you plant in the ground, and they and it makes a flower? Right. And at the height of the bubble, one tulip bulb would sell for the what is today $1.5 million, a mansion. And what happens when you put a tulip bulb in the ground? They do what other living creatures do. They try to reproduce. So eventually there are going to be tulip bulbs coming out of people's ears, and the price crashed. And every time you hear people say, it's a new era, it's different this time, the old way of valuing stock or houses or tulip bulbs or whatever are gone. Ooh, is it too late to get in? Yeah. Each time they're wrong. And what comes next? Oh boy, don't you know it. Crash. Right. Slide 11. Taxes. Oh, come on, Piana. Why are you always bringing up taxes? Because it's important. And the news is good. Because if you hold your stocks for more than a year, the Congress is going to reward you. The Congress is going to say, you know what? We are going to tax you at a smaller rate than if you earned income, which has been extremely rewarding for very wealthy individuals. They structure their income so that they don't really get income. They get capital gains. One of them used to be ran for president in 2012, Mitt Romney. And so it's been a very big difference for the wealthy. And then another gift from Bush in 2002 or 2003 was that dividends were traditionally taxed as income, taxed at your marginal rate. But he got the Congress to say, no, we want to tax dividends at the same low rate as long-term capital gains. And I understand the reasoning, you know, you want to encourage stock investing, but it's been a huge windfall for the very wealthy. And so, you know, when they take umbrage, like that word umbrage, the Republicans get upset when people say that you're only helping the wealthy. Well, you know, there's some truth to that. And I'm not, hey, listen to me. I'm a stockbroker. I love stocks. I understand it. I want to get wealthy from stocks and everything. But it's hard to argue with that. It has been the success has been unequally divided amongst members of our society. Slide number 12. Where do you buy your stocks? Well, it used to be that you had these traditional brokerage firms. You've heard of Merrill Stench and Morgan Stanley. I'm sorry, Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley. Excuse me. These companies are still around, and they really don't want you unless you have, it used to be 50,000, then it was 100,000. And then I heard someone say to me that this broker said he doesn't take anybody unless they have $500,000, and he's thinking of upping it to 750. And I say, you know what? I'm happy with somebody with $50 a month. They're the people who need the help. Somebody has $500,000, $700,000. They don't need your help. I mean, it's good to help them. They deserve it. But right. So stay away from these full service brokers unless you're so well endowed monetarily. The internet brokerage firms are sometimes called deep discount brokers, and they have their problems. But there are actually some decent deals out there. I think Schwab is not a bad. I've had seen people with their accounts at Schwab. I've seen what they've charged them and the like, and it's not bad. It's not bad. Whereas the full service brokers, they're going to charge you a lot, but they'll send you a bottle of wine on your birthday and take you to the steakhouse, and that makes sense. But there are other low cost options. There are what are called dividend reinvestment plans and low cost direct investment plans, where you go directly to the company and invest with the company directly. Well, you don't really do that. They hire somebody to do it. You know, the Coca-Cola is making fizzy sugar water with a brown crayon in it. But if you go to Coca-Cola and say, I want to buy your shares, they'll say, hey, here's the website. You know, you're dealing with another company that they hired to do this for them. And you can get to buy their shares directly from them, no commissions, almost no cost, pennies. They sometimes charge you pennies, you know, because they got to make it worth their while, but they're not trying to make a profit. The National Association of Investors Corps has their own direct investment plan, which helps people. So there are ways to buy shares, and you don't have to deal with a full-service broker. And it used to be, some people still get their stocks in certificate form, but don't do this, folks. They don't want to deal with these certificates. Everything's electronic now. But if you're the kind of person who stuffs their money in the mattress and buries your gold coins in the backyard, maybe you're interested in these certificates. On the website are a few examples, because they are beautiful. Some of them are really beautiful. The ones that were traded the most, I mean, after the certificate was used, the certificate, when it's still valid, is worth, you know, X amount of shares, 10 shares or 100 shares of stock. But then when you cash it in, they mark it, you know, it's like a cash check. They stamp it, and they say, okay, you've sold those shares. But then the certificates themselves have an afterlife. They get traded like baseball cards. And the one that was the most popular is still the most popular is Disney's, because they're actually pretty, they're very colorful and beautiful. And Disney got out of this business. They said, no more stock certificates, because people would buy one share and hang it on the wall. And then Disney's like, give me a break. this is we're trying to run a business here, you know. But these people are buying and selling their canceled certificates, and they're making them generate more of them. So they said, no more. So I guess that just means the people who own them, they're worth more than they did before. Okay, so check those out on the web. Traditional brokerage firms will assign you to an account executive, a stockbroker, a financial planner, a financial representative. The legal term is registered representative. That's the legal term. But the most common term is a stockbroker. This is a licensed individual who buys and sells securities on their client's behalf. And it's a tough test that we'll talk about later on. But once you don't have to have a degree. And now they're going to want you eventually to have a degree, but they need more people who can speak Spanish. They want more women. They need more people with other languages, Tagalog and Arabic. So if you have a second language, think about it, folks. Brokers were typically paid by commissions, and they were sometimes accused of what was called churning the accounts. Now, I know it happens. I've seen the aftermath of some people's accounts that have been churned. I've never met anybody who is this unethical. That doesn't mean they're not out there. They're out there, folks. And so visit FINRA.org and www.finra.org, and you can check up on your potential broker, your potential brokerage firm, and see if there's any hanky-panky going on. Right? Yeah, exactly. Now, let's spend a few moments talking about the different types of stocks. People tend to lump stocks all into one basket. Oh, folks, nothing could be further from the truth. No way! I mean, that's the most fun about stock investing, in my humble opinion, because there's just so many different types of companies and so many different types of industries and histories of companies, and so one person will ever know everything about all the different companies. So there's always more to learn, and which I love. That's why I love teaching this. I love doing it. Business 123. We study many different companies in detail. Let's take a look. Let's spend a few minutes on discussing the different types of companies. And these are just some of the most wide, large categories. Peter Lynch does a very good job of describing these types in his book, One Up on Wall Street. And the largest companies, the safest, now remember safe, so they still go down, folks, are blue chip stocks. Blue chip stocks are the largest companies like GE, AT&T, Coca-Cola, strong, respected companies. Sometimes people call them value stocks, and they attract conservative investors. Now, this has nothing to do with liberal conservative politics, folks. Conservative investors are people who are worried about risk. They want to invest in stocks, yes, we do, but they want to invest prudently. And these companies, are they going to explode on the upside? No. I mean, how much larger can GE get? But at the same time, they're not going to fall into the porcelain oasis when the organic matter hits the Ventolin device. They're going to hold up. So people invest in, I believe, these companies as the majority of their companies. They should make up the bulk of your investing. Right, your stalwarts, as Peter Lynch calls them. The next category are often associated with blue chips, and those are called income stocks. They are companies that pay higher than average dividends. They're normally slow growth companies in mature industries. And the poster child for this type of company is the utility. Right. Are utilities going anywhere? Do people want to all of a sudden take cold showers in the dark? No. Right? SDG&E, San Diego Gas and Electric, isn't exploding on the upside. They're never going to... They witnessed explosive growth in the 1950s and 60s when San Diego became a major metropolitan area. But after that, no. Banks, well, in the 2000s, banks started to get risky and started playing games with our money, which they shouldn't have done. But banks are typically income-oriented stocks because they're boring. At least they should be, because that's what banks are supposed to be. They're supposed to be boring. So these companies are going to pay you better than average dividends, but they're not going to give you huge capital gains. Slide 15, growth stocks. Oh, the growth stocks are the stars, folks. These are the stocks with the beautiful teeth and the gorgeous hair, the $200 haircut, and the beautiful pecs and abs and six packs and 12 packs and 20, I don't know, whatever. They're on the cover of GQ and Vanity Unfair. Yeah, you know these companies. They're talked about in the news all the time. They earn above average profits of all the firms in the economy, growth rate 15-20%, which might not sound a lot, but at a growth rate of 20% in 3 years, you'll be twice as large as you are now. Often no dividends at all, or a small token amount. Why? Because those earnings need to be reinvested back in the company. So you're not going to get much dividends from these. The stock price should go up as the business grows, but it's going to be volatile. They're looking at the growth rate. They're looking at the growth of the growth. And for you math friends, you math fans, you've heard of the first derivative? Well, growth investors are also looking at the second derivative. How fast is the growth growing? And if you don't know what I just said, don't worry about it. but when that growth starts to slow, wham! Exactly. People dump the shares, the prices plummet, which is then often a good time to pick up the pieces. And let's take a look at some examples here. Intel, Hewlett-Packard, wait a minute. Are Intel, Hewlett-Packard, Microsoft growth stocks anymore? No. They are mature companies in mature industries. Right. It is PCs and software, they're who are the growth companies? Right, they're the farce books, fleece books, the titters of the world, and Google, right, and I'm sorry, Twitter, right, and so the social media are the darling companies now, plus Amazon, who else, Apple, Netscape was 20 years ago, my apologies. And so those are the companies that are exploding on the upside. And the stock price has, done really well. But watch what happens when that growth... Right. Slide number 16. Now, on the other side of this multi-sided coin are cyclical stocks. Cyclical? Does that mean the round companies? No. Cyclical stocks follow the business cycle of advances and declines in the economy. What? When the economy is doing well, and people are getting new jobs, and incomes are rising, what do? Let's go buy a new car! Yeah! Let's go buy a new car! Why? What's wrong with the old car? I want a new car! I like that new car smell. It's good for my kidneys, and my liver, and my brain cells. No. Automobiles are the poster child for cyclical stocks. When the economy is doing well, people want a new car. And the car companies make a ton of money. What happens when the economy does poorly? Do people sell? Right, they hang on to their cars, and they don't buy new cars. They don't sell their old car. They hang on to the old car. And the car companies get hammered. Which is why I was sure in the mid-2000s, I said, look, GM's going to get trounced. And sure enough, I kept saying, you know, bet against DM. I didn't do it. I should have, but I didn't want to. I don't want companies to do poorly, except for Microsoft. And sure enough, when the economy did poorly, GM went under. Chrysler went under through bankruptcy. Ford didn't. Ford begged, borrowed, and stole everything they could to keep alive, and they did. And who else are cyclical companies? Timber, steel, chemicals. Yeah, companies that make stuff. And now, computer chips. Because in everything that is created, you need steel and aluminum and copper and timber, and now you need computer chips. Right, so that's a cyclical stock. On the other side of this multi-sided coin are defensive stocks. It's exactly not defense. No, they don't build airplanes and jet fighters and tanks. No, they are companies that hold their own when the economy tanks. Why? Because they make products that people buy no matter what. Kellogg's, like cereal, right? Procter & Gamble, soap, toilet paper, Pampers, shaving cream. Pfizer, they make drugs. Do you eat more Cheerios? Do you shave more? Do you take more drugs if the economy's doing well? No. You take what you need. And do you eat less cereal because the economy's doing well? Maybe you don't buy the most expensive cereal, but you still need food. You still need soap. You still need your whatever drugs you have to take if you need to take drugs. So these companies, they won't do fabulously when the economy is doing really, really well, when there's a big growth spurt. But when the economy has hit the doldrums, they shine. In fact, many investors, they're not really investors, they're traders, speculators, they will rush to these defensive stocks. And when everybody else is going down, they'll go up. Very interesting. You got to watch this. You know, you got to watch these guys because they tend to be counter-cyclical, as opposed to the cyclical stocks, which are cyclical. Now, turnarounds, slide 17. I like to call them goners. And these folks, for the vast majority of us, we should just stay away from these companies. These are companies that have fallen on hard times. And the question for you as a potential investor is there a potential for a rebound? Because usually they don't rebound. Kodak's gone. Kmart's almost gone. Polaroid's gone. Right? Enron. These companies, all the tech companies that fell in the internet bubble crashing, they're gone. They ain't coming back. But sometimes they do. In the early 1980s, Chrysler almost disappeared. Almost. A gentleman by the name of Lee Iacocca. And if you're into business and case studies, you want to read his autobiography, it's pretty good, or just read about him. He turned Chrysler around with the minivan. Yeah, it had been on the drawing board, and they never produced it. He said, you got to get, and he came in. He actually was the guy who developed the Mustang at Ford. And he left, he went to Chrysler, and he said, I'll work for a dollar. He got lots of stock, don't worry. He was very rich. But he saw this minivan they said, you know, we're working on this thing, we never really developed. Get it out there now! We want it! And of course, minivans became a huge part of the industry. Who are the turnarounds now? GM, Ford, and Chrysler. And it looks like they've done a pretty darn good job, so we'll see. So the idea, if you saw the presentation on the Ford bonds in Chapter 11, wait till you see the presentation for Ford stock in Chapter 12. It went down to $1.60 or so, I forget, $1.50, and I kept saying, buy it, don't worry, it's going to go under. Yeah, right, it didn't, so I didn't buy it. How about asset plays? Now, asset plays, again, are a little tricky, like the turnarounds, but these are not tricky because the turnarounds usually don't turn around. These are tricky because it's hard to see through the company and see the assets that other people don't see. You look at JCPenney's. You know, well, JCPenney's has had a rough time in the last couple of decades. There have been times when it's been on the ropes. Just a few years ago, it was really in trouble. But they have an insurance division that they could easily sell. That's one of those insurance companies that sells you insurance for your baby, which makes a ton of money, but not good for you. And if JCPenney's were in serious trouble, they could sell that part of the company. And you may have heard of PepsiCo, right? Pepsi Cola, and people think, oh, they sell soft drinks. What do they make most of their money off? I don't know if most, but they make a lot of money off of? They own Frito-Lay. They own, right, the food that is outrageously expensive and makes you fat and sick. So buy PepsiCo. They used to own the Kentucky Fried Rat, Taco Smell, and Pizza Craft. I'm sorry, what are they called? Kentucky Fried Chicken, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell. Right, they used to own those. They sold them. So, is it a soft drink company? Yes, but it also has hidden assets. Very good, very good. Now, this last one, as we've already made mention of this, is called Penny Stocks. You've heard of Butterfly.com and Flim Flam Incorporated? Right, they make Blue Steam. It's going to be a winner, folks. It's a whole lot better than the left-handed smoke shifter that they sold last year that didn't ever get off the drawing board. And then that bacon stretcher that turned out to be a real loser. Yeah, these are not companies, folks. They're shams. They're scams. And there are people out there ready to take your money if you invest in them. So stay away from penny stocks. I don't care what anybody tells you. They are, and by the way, mostly they're illegal. Not the company itself, but trying to make money off of these penny stocks by pumping up the price and then dumping it. That's not legal, although people do it all the time. Okay, so slide 18. We're ready to now take a look at several different companies and try to decide what type of stock it is. Huh? Well, why don't you pause and you decide instead of me telling you, but this is what we do in the face-to-face class. But now I'll tell you. Johnson & Johnson, what are they? You know what they make, right? Baby powder, Q-tips, Band-Aids, and they make a ton of other products, medical products. Stents, what are those things? They're little bubbles that you put in an artery to keep people from dying. What are they? Well, they're a blue-chip company. They've been around for over 100 some odd years, I forget. Are they income? They pay a little bit of income. You know, not bad. Not bad. Not fabulous, but pretty darn good. And are they growth, cyclic, or no, they're not a growth company. They're a defensive company. Why? Because no matter how bad the economy gets, you need a Band-Aid, you go out and buy a Band-Aid. Right, exactly. So they're a defensive company. Most healthcare companies are. There are some that are growth companies with, you know, new technologies and the like. What about ExxonMobil? ExxonMobil, what is that? It's a blue chip, right? It's one of the largest companies in the world. So it's been around for over 100 years just to be Standard Oil in various forms of one another. So it's a blue chip. Is it income? Yeah, they pay not bad income, not the best, but not bad. Is it growing? Well, there is a trajectory over the long term for growth of oil consumption, and it is increasing as the world's population becomes more and more industrialized, but they're not growing in leaps and bounds. It's cyclical. There's always a need for oil, but as the economy zooms along, we need more stuff, and one of them is oil, because oil is in virtually everything. So Exxon is a cyclical stock. Okay, now Google. Google it, right. High tech. Are they a blue chip stock? Well, you know, they'll tell you they're a blue chip stock. They're one of the world's largest companies, but, you know, the McDonald's and the G's will look at them and say, oh my God, they've only been around for 10, 15 years. I mean, how can they be a blue chip company? They pay a little bit of dividends, but no, they're one of the stocks that is on the cover of People magazine, right? They're a growth company, and their teeth are perfect. Exactly, and everybody wants to be like Google, including Facebook. What about Sempra Energy? Who are they? Well, they're the company that's based here in San Diego that owns SDG&E. They're the holding company, and they have a few other things going on, but they're mostly SDG&E. And so, is that a blue chip company? Well, it's not really that big, not really that blue, but it's certainly an income stock. Yes, it is, because utilities are the poster child for income stocks. They're pumping out electricity and gas, and people don't want to take cold showers in the dark. General Mills. Cheerios! Right? Wheaties! and a lot of other foodstuffs. Blue chip, yes, yes, they are a blue chip company, and they are a defensive company. Why? Because you don't eat more Cheerios because the economy's doing really, really well, and you don't eat less Cheerios because the economy's doing really, really well. What about International Paper? What do they make? Well, they make paper, right? But when you make paper, you also make timber. They're byproducts of each other. So they make stuff. And what do we know about companies that make stuff? They're cyclical. It's also blue chip. It's been around forever. So companies that make stuff like paper, like timber, they're cyclical companies. Now, Union Pacific Railroad, one of the nation's remaining railroads out of the 400 that were in the 1840s. They're a blue chip. Oh, yeah, they're a big company. But what can we say about railroads? Exactly. They're cyclical. Why? Because before the stuff can be made, it's got to get to the place to make it. And then once it's made, it's got to get to the place to sell it. So transportation is cyclical. And in fact, many investors, short-term oriented, will look at the transportation sector of the economy to try to divine, to try to foretell what's going to happen in the general economy in 6, 3, 6, 9 months, because the stuff's got to get there for, yeah, you got it. And another thing about Union Pacific Railroad is that it's an asset play. Huh? What are railroads sitting on that were given to them 160 years ago? They're sitting on tremendous land. In fact, the Chargers want to build a new stadium right where the railroad station is, so you know who's going to get paid, right? I think it's Burlington, Santa Fe or something. I'm not sure who owns that downtown railroad station, but you know they're going to get a ton of money for that land. Yeah. What about GM? Ooh, well, it used to be the bluest of the blue chip companies. Not anymore. Well, they're coming back. They're coming back. And as a automobile company, they would typically be cyclical. But we can safely say that they have been so far a successful turnaround. Because the GM you're looking at now ain't the same GM it was before 2008. That GM is gone. And if you own those shares, they are gone. The new company has new shares. Yes, they went through bankruptcy, and all the stock investors cried like the Missouri River because they lost their shirts on that. And that's why I kept saying it's going to go under. It's going to go under. I wasn't hoping for it, but I just saw it, and I didn't act on it. What about Flim Flam Incorporated? Right, that's a penny stock, folks. Stay away from them. I don't care what anybody says. They are scams. Stay away. And by the way, there's some 20,000 of these things out there at any one time, if you can believe that. Maybe not 20,000, but pretty darn close. General Dynamics. Some of you might know who they are. What do they build? Bullets, tanks, jet fighters, submarines, nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. So, yeah, I guess you consider they're a blue-chip company, but are they a growth company? Well, not really. Are they cyclical? No, they don't care about the business cycle. But they are cyclical. But they follow a geopolitical cycle. Exactly. Exactly. So that I put that in there. Why? Because I want to show you that some companies don't fit in any category. Some companies are their own little worlds. The defense contractors are their own little worlds, folks. And some people might tell you that defense and wars help economies. Wrong! That is so untrue. You don't want to bomb potential clients. It's not good business practice. So if anybody tries to tell you that you want a war to help the economy, they don't know what they're talking about, folks. We don't want wars. They kill people too, you know. But you don't want wars for the economic reasons. All right, so go back over this material. Make sure you understand it. If you have any questions, contact me. In our next presentation, we'll start to scratch the surface and take a look at the indices, stock market indices, and then stock market measures, how to measure and take a look at a company from a numeric viewpoint. Are you excited? Are you? I am. I don't know about you, but this stuff is, I just love this stuff. So, welcome to chapter 1 again. I mean, chapter 1, chapter 12 again, our first presentation of stocks, and we'll see you in our subsequent next presentation.